Before we get more into some of the clinical research, I'm curious about some of the translational studies that have been done. A couple that I found interesting are Sandy Swain's study in inflammatory breast cancer and actually Chris Willett's study in rectal cancer. Can you talk about those two and maybe other studies like that that I might not be aware of?
Well, one of the functions of VEGF, at least in some animal model systems, is by decreasing the vascular permeability and pruning the most non-functional of those vessels, it may actually improve transiently the perfusion of those tumors by decreasing the interstitial tumor pressure. Now, that's been very well documented by Rakesh Jain and his group in some of the animal systems. It's been much more difficult to document in human tumors because you need to be able to get a probe into the tumor to measure the interstitial pressure. Chris Willett did a very small study in patients with rectal cancer who were getting bevacizumab as an initial single dose alone and then in combination with radiation therapy. Now, there actually is a potential complicating factor that I don't think they controlled for in their study. So what they did is do a colonoscopy and measure with a direct probe inserted in the tumor from the luminal side the interstitial pressure before treatment and then after their first bevacizumab dose. But if you think about it, that probe measuring the interstitial pressure measures not just the interstitial pressure of the tumor, it also measures the intraluminal pressure in the colon. And to do the colonoscopy, you have to inflate the colon with gas. And they didn't actually measure the intraluminal pressure, and they didn't control for whether the colon was inflated to the same pressure or the same amount in those sequential colonoscopies. Not doing colonoscopies myself, it seems unlikely that you would have exactly the same pressure in the lumen. So without controlling for that, I think it's hard to interpret their data. Now, that data did show a decrease in interstitial pressure after bevacizumab, but it was a very small study. It was only 5 or 6 patients that they've reported on. So without controlling for the intraluminal pressure, it's a bit difficult to be positive that that data is correct. There is a separate study that was just recently reported in breast cancer that also measured interstitial pressure in patients with locally advanced primary breast cancers receiving neoadjuvant chemotherapy. And they looked at patients who were receiving either paclitaxel, which has been well studied and we know has some separate anti-angiogenic, anti-endothelial effects, or patients receiving doxorubicin, where that has really been very difficult to show. And their results were fascinating and are not complicated by this intraluminal pressure issue. They saw a significant decrease in the interstitial pressure in the patients receiving paclitaxel, but essentially no difference in the interstitial pressure in the patients receiving doxorubicin, even though the clinical responses with those two therapies were essentially identical.
And that was combined with bevacizumab?
No, that was with the chemotherapy alone.
Oh, just from chemotherapy?
Yeah, it was a fascinating, fairly small study in the neighborhood of 40 patients, but it was a fascinating investigation into the biology because even though the response rates were the same, the mechanism by which you achieved those responses might be quite different.
What do you think was going on?
I suspect that you saw a combination of both direct tumor effects and anti-angiogenic effects with the paclitaxel, and you only saw the direct cytotoxic effects with doxorubicin. And that would potentially account for why you saw a decrease in interstitial pressure with one drug but not with the other.
From my primitive non-laboratory science mind, when I hear about decreased interstitial pressure and increasing perfusion of chemotherapy into cells, that's about as much as I've been able to figure out about Chris Willett's study. It seems like that was a little counterintuitive in terms of what, quote, anti-angiogenesis was supposed to be doing.
It initially is, but if you delve a little bit deeper into the vasculature of a tumor, it starts to make sense. The vasculature of a tumor is an incredibly disordered, largely non-functional structure. It has lots of leaky vessels, it has lots of blind loops and things that don't connect, it has lots of areas where there is minimal or very sluggish flow with little microthrombi that tend to come and go. So there are a lot more vessels in a tumor than in normal tissue, but many of those vessels are not very functional. And those vessels that are not very functional tend to be the ones that don't have a lot of pericyte coverage. And the pericytes also provide critical survival signals. And without the pericytes, they are much more sensitive to inhibiting VEGF. So if you inhibit VEGF, one of the first things that happens is you prune those most sensitive, least functional components of the tumor vasculature, and that could lead to an increase in perfusion, at least transiently. Now, that's been well documented in animal studies, much more difficult to document in patients. And what is still not clear is to what extent, if any, that actually accounts for the clinical responses that we see. Because it may absolutely be true, but be completely unimportant for what these drugs actually accomplish for us in the clinic.